A conversation with Hugh Slater. This is the Tech Space brought to you by Alex Partners. We're a European founder-led executive search consultancy. Hello and welcome. I'm Giles Daniels, one of the founders of Alex Partners. I'm delighted to be joined today by Hugh Slater. Hugh is co-founder and CEO of Oliver, a UK-based mental health platform that empowers companies to support their people with accessible, high-quality care. Having lived and worked in the UK, Spain and the US, Hugh's global outlook informs his approach to building high-performing teams that excel in fast-paced environments. Inspired by business veterans like Keith Rabois, Sheryl Sandberg and Claire Hughes-Johnson, he combines operational rigour with a people-first ethos to nurture resilient teams that drive sustainable growth. I'm going to start the conversation, really, I suppose, Hugh, right back at the start, for your journey from leaving university and how you got into tech effectively.
Good morning, Giles. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm happy to tell you the story. It's not a standard one. I don't know if anyone's story is standard, by the way. But so I did a degree in astrophysics. Again, I'm not quite sure how I got into that, just being a geek, I guess. So, yeah, studied astrophysics up in the wonderful Manchester. By the way, they do not tell you how much it rains on the prospectus for Manchester. So, yeah, a good few years up there and didn't really know what I wanted to do after that. Didn't want to stay in academia. So went to a careers fair, ended up getting a job at British Telecom. So joined their finance graduate scheme out of university. And again, I didn't know what that meant either. So I just went in and, you know, did what I was told for a few years. But yeah, I did all right at BT. It's a massive organization, gave me huge sort of learning opportunities to the point where I didn't leave for 10 years, right? Just stuck around, kept taking challenge after challenge. Probably talk a bit about that later. But after 10 years and some ups and downs, some pretty big downs actually, which we might touch on, but ups and downs through BT after 10 years, that's when sort of met yourself and Nina. And was looking for a jump into tech. You know, at the time I was finance director in service delivery. It's like a £2 billion P&L in BT Openreach. It just wasn't setting me alight. It wasn't inspiring for me. And I kind of thought, you know, I could spend another 10 years at BT and probably not do much new. And wanted to get into tech. You know, this was back in 2013, was it? It was a long time ago now.
It was 2013, yeah. Was it specifically a SaaS sort of high-growth startup you're looking for? I can't remember at the time.
Yeah, it was. I'm just a geek, as per the astrophysics. So I love technology, hardware and software. But back then, that was just when SaaS was really taking off as a business model and the technology sort of behind it. And it was the perfect timing because a lot of these big US companies were coming to Europe. So I was very lucky, you know, Salesforce had obviously been over here for a little while, but companies like Box, who I ended up joining, were just starting their international expansion. And that was perfect for me because having been in a big company, I didn't really have the pure startup skills, or I certainly didn't have the experience of working in a tiny 10-person startup. So working for a US-based company that was starting up in Europe was kind of a great stepping stone for me. And the timing just worked out really well. So yeah, decided I was going to leave BT and spoke to you guys and you helped me find the role at Box. And it was scary, if I'm honest. You know, when you're at BT, you know, I had a team of 80 people onshore, offshore. You don't have to worry about invoicing or VAT or payroll. All of these things are just dealt with somewhere else in the organization. I joined Box and yeah, if you don't pay the invoice at the end of the month. I mean, we literally had bailiffs at the door, you know, within 2 months of me joining BT because we just hadn't paid a bill and there was bailiffs there. We had loads of money in the bank, just the invoice had forgotten to get paid, right? So it's things like that with just a massive shift. But I loved it out of the gate. I loved the technology. I loved the intensity. I loved the new learning curve. And yeah, I haven't looked back since basically. So went from Box, where I was sort of VP finance and operations, joined Typeform as well. Actually, at Box, we went through the IPO when I was there. So it was an amazing learning experience. Not often you get to see that sort of firsthand in any career. So very lucky to have that in my first stint in technology.
Did Box come to a natural end for you, really?
Yeah, it did. And I was very open. And this was a lot of self-reflection. Really, I left BT half because of culture, you know, fighting this sort of slow culture at the time, and half was my learning curve had plateaued, right? And I didn't really know that. It was just a gut feeling when I left BT. But by the time I was 3 odd years into Box, I recognized that that learning curve is a huge motivator for me. And it was starting to plateau. And Dylan, who was my boss, the CFO and co-founder there, fantastic guy. Him and Aaron are amazing. Yeah, I was talking to him about it. I was saying, you know, we've opened up entities all over Europe, Australia, Canada, but it's more of the same, more of the same. And, you know, I need something new. In the end, I actually went and spent 6 months in California, worked with a channel sales team out there to try and help them sort of become more efficient and drive a bit more growth. That was a great experience. But in the end, it just wasn't really a job for me at Box that would sort of sustain that growth. So decided to leave and had a very sort of candid conversation with Dylan about that. And, you know, we managed the transition pretty well.
And there was the Typeform job based in Barcelona.
Yeah, that was right. And I think comes back to my childhood. I moved around a lot when I was a kid, so I wasn't scared of moving to Barcelona. I'd lived there before very briefly when I was young, loved it as a city. And the Typeform job took me out there as CFO. So it was another step up, you know, from VP finance to CFO and then moving abroad as well. So that was great. I mean, Typeform, totally different, right? So still B2B SaaS, but they're targeting much smaller businesses. Box was selling into enterprise. Typeform was selling into prosumers, really sort of, you know, really small organizations. And it was a design-led business rather than this sort of big enterprise tool. So, yeah, another fantastic sort of career change or, you know, career evolvement. Enjoyed that. But that also came to a natural end, I would say. So the founders were starting to step down there. It was becoming more professionalized. And they've gone on to do great things, but it wasn't the inspiring place that I joined. And at the same time, I'd met some people in Barcelona, you know, Javi mainly, who is now my co-founder, but he was the co-founder of TravelPerk. And this was pure coincidence. You know, my ex-wife and his wife were friends, met him at a party, got chatting, and he was, oh, you know, you've got to come and meet me and my co-founder. And before you know it, I'm sort of working for TravelPerk. So yeah, 2 years at Typeform, then joined TravelPerk very early in their journey. There were 1 million of ARR, 120 people, something like that, when I joined them. Again, still in Barcelona, and then was with TravelPerk, not the journey I was expecting. You know, had a year of hyper growth and then COVID, and it's a business travel platform. So as you can imagine, there wasn't much growth going on during that. But yeah, amazing leadership team there, amazing products, obviously. And, you know, we made some pretty smart decisions through that COVID period that sort of took us on a good trajectory coming out.
Okay, brilliant. So I suppose the reason why we're doing this podcast today is because when we invited you, probably September last year, to an event, you couldn't come, but that was Toby Flood, the ex-England rugby player, talking about the transition from sport into business and the successful characteristics, I guess, that he took from sport into business and being part of high-performing teams and things. And you mentioned about managing for results versus expectations, which definitely sort of piqued my interest. And I guess that, if you go through BT, Box, Typeform and TravelPerk, I guess all the experience you've picked up along the way is probably what gave you the, I don't know, passion, the right word or whatever, in terms of what, I don't know what word you would use, to start Oliver, you know, and the things that that stands for and what it does. So firstly, just talk a little bit for perhaps people who might not know around results, what you mean by results versus expectations from a management perspective.
Yeah, the sort of phrase results versus performance, and I think it's quite intuitive. It sounds a bit bizarre, but it's quite intuitive, because at the end of a football match or rugby match, right, you'll hear the manager or coach speak and they'll say best result of the season but not our best performance, you know, or best performance of the season but not the result we wanted. So we know those two things are different, but for some reason when we get into a work environment, more often than not, we just talk about results. Did you achieve that objective? And we're not looking at the performance that's gone into it. And again, in some teams, you kind of know this because there'll be a bluebird deal that comes in and somebody will, you know, smash their quota and everyone's like, oh, this isn't fair. And so there are some times when it's a bit more obvious.
Then you've got to pay them loads of commission. Yeah,
exactly. And nobody wants to. And then you have caps and all these weird things going on, right? So it's a bit ugly in business, but I think it's really important. And I mean, we saw this in TravelPerk, right? So that COVID period, there were no results. In fact, we kind of made up this fictional KPI, sort of potential travel budget under management, which didn't mean anything, right? Nobody was spending any money, but it was potential travel. So had to come up with this fictional result as a proxy for a real result. But we made sure the performance went in and day out. So it's understanding that those two are different. And over time, they should be the same, right? So over time, if you're not putting in the right performance, clearly you're not going to get the results. But in the moment, quite often the different metrics, if you like, to be looking at. So I think it's a really important thing, you know, if you're managing a sales team. And again, sales is better at this, I think, than lots, because how many calls have you made today? You know, how many contracts have you sent out? These are kind of the performance metrics, the leading indicators for the results at the end. But if you're in an HR team or an ops team or, you know, an engineering team, I don't think we do a good job overall as leaders of thinking about those performance metrics that lead to the result.
So does some of this then, and I guess on a higher level, does it lead into, so let's say you've got a sales guy, and I've worked in recruitment for 25 years. So you can imagine when I started out, you know, you had a bad day, you got slated, people got hired and fired like nobody's business, right? But you just can't treat people like that anymore. You can't manage like that anymore. So is there an element of when you're, not necessarily financially, but acknowledging and rewarding people for the job they're doing, as opposed to necessarily being 120% a target or even, you know, 80% a target, whatever it is. Is that all part of the, like, so rather than having people get really disengaged because they've had a shit quarter and leaving, what you're almost doing is saying, look, right, the results aren't there, but let's manage them in a different way and let's be positive about the things that you are doing and the steps that you are taking in the right direction to get those results. And I know that a lot of people pay lip service to that because we all, from the management perspective, we all as a leader in a sales environment want to be seen to be rewarding people for doing the right things. But at the end of the day, at the end of the quarter, if the results aren't there, then it's a problem. And I've worked in many companies, certainly early in my career, where it's that thing of, it's like the footballer or the rugby player, isn't it? Goes through an academy and they're told they're the best things in sliced bread and they're the best footballer that they've seen and they're going to be the next Messi and Ronaldo until the day that they're not. And then it's like, oh, I know yesterday we said that you're going to be the next Ronaldo, but by the way, that your contract's come to an end. You need to go and find a job in, you know, whatever. And people just get left. So I think probably as employers, we are definitely more responsible for the people that we employ than we were 10 years ago and certainly 20, 30 years ago. So is that one of the things that's led you to Oliver?
So it's definitely one of the things, right? So I think as a leader or a manager, right, don't have to be some grandiose title, but as a manager, the performance of your team and the results of your team are your accountability. And again, I think what a lot of people, and certainly I did early in my career, is you forget that the performance framework, right? So the things that you're going to measure people on in terms of their performance, as well as the results, and we'll use sales as the example, right? So the result is hitting your quota, and the performance might be the number of calls a day or contracts issued or whatever the thing is that you're going to measure. That performance framework, those things that you're measuring people on day in and day out, that's your responsibility. And if they hit all of those performance metrics but do not achieve their result, then you as a manager should question yourself, have I set up the right performance framework? Am I asking them to do the right thing? Right? Now, if everyone else in your team is following that framework and getting the results, you should be pretty confident that your performance framework is right. But if nobody's achieving their results, then it's your job as the manager to go and look at those performance frameworks. But quite often we just put it on the individual salesperson. You've missed your result for the second quarter in a row. Out you go. And I just think that's bad management, bad leadership, right? You can do that at a company level, you can do it at a team level, but it's the leader's responsibility for that performance framework in order to get the results. And the two are different. So I think that's just to sort of close the loop on that previous bit. The big thing that led me to Oliver is I always had this love for teams, but I guess it comes from playing rugby, right? So I love teams. I've always loved being part of teams. Throughout my time at BT, the culture wasn't, if I'm honest, wasn't psychologically safe, right? So I love building my teams. I love trying to, you know, help them. I tried to, didn't know it at the time, tried to create psychological safety, but I wasn't in an environment where I felt psychologically safe, right? I just thought if I fail, I'm going to get the axe at any moment. So I kind of knew this stuff in myself, but wasn't surrounded by it externally. When I joined Box, that changed dramatically. All of a sudden, you're in this tech environment where psychological safety, you know, fail fast, all of these things are spoken about day in, day out. And it really brought me alive. Like I felt I'd come home. I felt I'd just belong in this environment. And that meant what I was doing with my team naturally at Box, I could do with the team naturally at BT. I was doing with the team at Box, but in a broader environment that encouraged it and kind of, and then you see the performance change. And, you know, I still speak to some of the team now and they've gone on to fantastic things. And we look back on that period of our careers with a lot of love, right? It was really enjoyable, but we did really hard things and achieved a lot. So that transition from BT to Box taught me that the environment that you're in matters a lot. You know, what I was doing at BT, I was fighting against the culture, right? The broader culture. And when I joined Box, I'm working with that culture. So you've got this amazing tide kind of pushing you forwards. So the environment really matters. And then, you know, you go on and in the end, I've managed probably thousands of people by now. You realize that, fine, you have the environment, you have the individual skill, but then shit happens in life, you know? And it's sad but true, and it's not often spoken about, but there's bereavements, right, in families. Sometimes there's bereavements in the team, right? There's cancers, there's whatever. You're a new parent. All of these things happen in life that actually impact you deeply, and you can't show up to work at your best when those things are going on. And I've had that. Yeah, I think, you know, my father passed away when I was at BT. I had no idea what to do. You know, more recently, I went through a divorce. That impacted me. And you just know you can't show up to work when those things are happening. So this combination of creating an environment where people can thrive, and that's different for everyone. You know, people have different sort of traits, but creating an environment that people can thrive in and then supporting them when they need it. And those two things have come together perfectly for me at Oliver, and that's why we exist, right? We want to help the business create the environments where employees can thrive and help the employees when they need it the most.
Okay. And so what you're doing, does that work better in bigger companies, right? Because if you think about a small startup, if you think about what you're doing at Oliver for a small startup environment like Box was when you start, and if you've got a team of 15 and you've got one who's going through a divorce and one who's had a bereavement in the family, that's sort of, you're 15% of your workforce down, aren't you? Whereas if you're in a 5,000 person company and you've got 100 people who've got things going on, then it's a whole different dynamic. And so how does that translate? Like supporting your salespeople when they're doing the right things until the end of the month when you fire them because they haven't hit the numbers.
Yeah.
Is it a bit the same with, well, we really care about your mental well-being and we understand that you're going through a divorce and we understand that you've had a bereavement, but you've missed your number.
Exactly. So that is what we see in bigger companies. And you can see it by the products that they buy. So bigger companies tend to buy EAPs, employee assistance programs, right? Which are, they have their place, by the way, but they're reactive, you know, it's, and they're hard to use. So you have a bereavement and it, or it might be financial, you've got a financial scare and you try and get through to some help through these systems. And Health Assured were in the press quite recently about they put barriers in the way of you getting to that help, right? Because they cost maybe £1 a month per employee. So it's nothing. So by definition, for those EAPs to make money, they have to make it really hard for you to actually speak to a human to get help. And when you've got a 100,000 person organization, that's really all you can afford. You can't help everyone in that organization access therapy or a financial advisor. So big organizations tend to spend much less. And it makes sense, right? Because if one person or 10 people or even 100 people out of 100,000 disappear, you know, if they go below the line and unfortunately, you know, they leave work for whatever reason, it's just small cogs in a massive machine. And it makes sense. That would be the rational decision for the CEO of that company to make. Conversely, if you're in 100 person, 150 person startup, scale up, you know, you're trying to go from 150 people to 1,000 people, losing 10 people because of new parents, divorce, whatever, that's a big problem, right? So you can't achieve your huge ambitious growth goals if, and it doesn't have to be your best people, just if your core people are not at their best. And that's a completely different dynamic. And it's one, obviously, me, Javi, and Sanch, my co-founders, have lived through and we recognize it. So we're helping those organizations, right? Those people with huge, ambitious goals that really rely on their people to go above and beyond, be really autonomous and, you know, see things and just act fast. We're helping those companies sort of achieve everything they want. And it's much more rational. I think the business decisions are much more rational. And it's you know, if Jane doesn't come back from maternity leave, what the hell are we going to do? You know, she's amazing. We need her in her role. So, of course, we're going to support her coming back. So it's just a very different dynamic. And we love working with sort of tech scale-ups as well.
So is that really where you come from? Is that what you're focusing on? So is Oliver predominantly aimed at high-growth, fast-paced technology companies, or is it across the board?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely across the board. We're happy to support anyone. I mean, the target audience at the moment is scale-ups, right? Hyper-growth scale-ups. We do sell to different organizations, but the core thing is sustained high performance. And sustained really matters because, again, there are industries where they're quite happy to burn people out. You know, some financial institutions or sales teams, for example. So actually, I don't care. I'm going to get my money's worth from you for 18 months and then you can go on to... And that's not who we want to sell to. Right? It's people who want sustained high performance, which I think we all know that's what makes a difference. I mean, England won the World Cup after 10 years of that team playing together. The first couple of years were a bit shaky, right? And then went on to great things. So the high performance comes from being sustained. And that's what I want to help people with.
Yeah, and trust and understanding and knowing your team. And I guess that's another point, isn't it? That it's easier in a way to be a collective team in a smaller, high-growth company where you're all pulling in the same direction than a massive organization where you've got, you know, dozens of different departments that all basically just play their part in a much bigger machine.
I mean, this is a core part, I think, of sustained high performance is autonomy. Okay, so if you are in a big corporate, processes are well documented, right? It's more of a compliance environment, right? So please follow this process, don't deviate from it. Deviating from the process is a performance problem, right? So we'll literally come and, you know, tap you on the shoulder and ask you to leave. That is not true when you're innovating, right? If you're in a tech company, every day you're innovating, whether you're in product team or finance, something's changed, you've got to react to that. And you want the autonomy to go and do it. I think you need to build an environment where you can thrive, where people can thrive in that autonomous environment. It's a big difference between corporates and tech companies.
That's interesting. So I've obviously spent my career selling to high growth businesses and C-level and founders, and you know, there are quite a few big egos at that level. And so most CEOs would say that they've got a great company with a great culture and it's a great environment and people love working for them. So how do you sell against that, and how do you get the buying persona, whoever it is, to actually realize the value that Oliver can add to their business? You know, I'm assuming you're not getting many inbound leads.
We actually get most of our leads inbound. Funnily enough, yeah, hardly any outbounds going on.
Do you? Right, okay.
Look, it's changed over the last 4 or 5 years. So during COVID, you know, we've been around 4 and a bit years now. So during COVID, there was a lot of inbound and people just, you know, people are stressed, anxious. We just need to support our staff. That was it. That was the need. There was this sort of, yeah, horrible situation going on. And everyone wanted to support. It was also the zero interest rate era. There was a lot of cash. You know, employees had the power. They were deciding which companies to go to. So there was a lot of benefits spend going on as well. So again, that was kind of a boom phase, if you like. So you're not really selling against much then. You just, there's a lot of demand in the environment. That is not the world we're in now. People want to know, you know, if I'm spending an extra $100 a year on an employee, what's the return on investment there? And again, you do have different personas. There are CEOs who just want to push everyone to the brink of burnout. It's almost a badge of honor, you know, if you're burning out. But we won't sell into those businesses. That's totally fine. You know, we're not for everyone, but we are for the people who want that sustained high performance. And you can see it in metrics. So you can see it in employee churn, right? You can see it in percentage of people coming back from parental leave. Like, these are all signals that tell you what the environment is. Do your staff feel supported in the workplace? And it's not just that, you know, we do the therapy side, which is more the personal bit. We do the professional coaching and we do group coaching. One of the big things that we're working on at the moment with some of our customers is first line managers. right? So these companies grow really quickly. You end up over promoting people, you know, managers don't know how to manage staff.
Yeah, best sales guy gets the sales director job, yeah.
Exactly, classic mistake, right? Classic, and then the whole team disappears because your sales manager's terrible.
Steals the clients.
Yeah, yeah, that's it, takes a book with them. So we're supporting scale-ups with helping their managers build psychological safety, for example, helping managers to understand how to have tough conversations, to give feedback. It's back to creating that environment where people can perform. And if you're really the main point of contact that an individual has with the business is through the manager, right? So if that manager is not showing up to work well, if they're not giving feedback, the environment crumbles really quickly. So if you think about it like an environment, it's helping the individuals, whether it's professional development or whether it's sort of overcoming some personal challenge. And then it's the managers that you've got to work with. And we'll do both of those.
And so are most people open for a conversation from a sales perspective because they do care about their people and, you know, they're on the front foot with it and want to build that great culture environment with people who are developing and will stay and they see it as an investment in the company's future? Or is it usually because, you know, something has happened and they realise that they've fallen short? Or is it a mixture of both?
It's definitely a mixture of both. There's almost three. There's a company that just wants to give great benefits to their employees and they see investing in mental health as a benefit. Right? So that's one bucket. The other bucket is people who are being proactive about their scale-up journey. Like, this is going to be tough. We're going to ask a lot from our people and we need to support them on that journey. And again, that could be therapy or professional growth. And then there's the reactive side, which is, unfortunately, we do see it. It's, you know, we've had a death in the team, right? And we need you to come in and sort of coach us through it and give support to those impacted around it. So they're the three sort of common types. The first and last, we see quite rarely now, that it's that middle section. There's enough scale-ups now across Europe and in the US that people are, this is really tough. We're asking a lot from everyone in the organization. We're driving performance much harder than we used to. And we need to support people in that journey. Otherwise, you know, we'll just churn the team.
So a lot of the companies you're talking to now, it's that they've gone from being a nice to have to being a must have.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, we've shifted from purely being mental health, you know, just giving therapy to doing the professional growth and then the group coaching for managers and leaders as well. So, you know, we've reacted to that shift in the market as well.
And talking about culture, are most companies nowadays, because certainly I've seen change a bit in recruitment, are most companies, most leaders, are they self-aware? You know, do they realise the shortcomings of the business from a cultural perspective? Or, you know, are they more aware of the things that they could be done better? Or do you think there is still that sort of that bravado of almost thinking their company is the best?
It's definitely a mixed bag. I'd love to say everyone's, you know, shifted and, you know, self-aware. It's not that at all. And people have their own personal experiences. You know, it's if you've been successful because you've worked extremely hard, have been, you know, whipped by a boss in some previous job, then that's what you think drives success. And you see that just carried through. Thankfully, you know, the stigma's reducing on mental health issues and people are much more vulnerable about it and talk about it now. So thankfully, the tide is definitely shifting and generationally it's shifting as well. You know, Gen Zs are obviously much more aware and they're becoming, I think by 2030, they're going to be 50% of the workforce. So that generational shift is making a big difference as well to organizations.
And I think that the younger people coming through now, they come to work for different reasons, don't they?
Completely. They're for a purpose, yeah.
Yeah, and very differently motivated, yeah. Okay, good. Brilliant, thanks. So we end every episode of the podcast with asking the question and reflecting on the past, what single piece of advice would you consider the most valuable to share with your 20-year-old self?
The main one I would give myself is put the work in to understand your core values, right? I haven't done that until much later in my career. Why do I give that advice? Because there are times in your life, personal and professional, where things don't feel right. You know, there's a decision being made by a leader or something's happening in your life and it just doesn't sit well with you. And unless you understand your core values, you really don't know why that is. And a large part of what led me to panic attacks and, you know, sort of burnout when I was in my latter years at BT was that there was things going on around me that were impacting me, but I didn't know myself well enough to know what conflict that was driving internally. So yeah, I think if you understand yourself better, you'll put yourself in the right environments, the right situations that go with your core values, and then you can work infinitely hard for infinitely long because everything's in sync.
Yeah, but I guess you've got to go through the ups and downs and take the bumps and things, haven't you, to actually work out what your core values are that make a difference for you personally.
I think, that's how old people like us do it, I would say. That is not the way you have to do it. That is definitely how we did it. But, you know, ChatGPT is a great tool. Go onto ChatGPT and ask it questions and work through your core values. And it'll give you a 90% good answer. You don't need to spend loads of money on a therapist to do it. That is work you can do yourself. And I encourage everyone to go through and do it. You definitely don't have to do it the hard way like we did.
Some way it shapes you though, doesn't it?
It definitely shapes you. And I think your values change over time, right? So it's not a static thing. That the experiences you have, or experiences I've had, have definitely changed the priorities in my core values, I would say. So yeah, not a static thing. But yeah, that would be my advice. Do the hard work to understand yourself.
That's great advice. That's brilliant. Thank you very much. Finally, where can people go to find out more about you and about Oliver?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Hugh Slater. You'll see my rambling posts there. And then oliver.health to come and find us. You'll see all the information on there.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Hugh. That was fantastic. Really interesting conversation. I was your host, Giles Daniels, and this is the Tech Space podcast series brought to you by Alex Partners. Thank you for listening. Stay subscribed and join us for a new episode very soon. Thank you.